I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And here we go with another episode of An Athlete's Blueprint. Have you ever fancied yourself as a racing driver? Today I'm joined by William St. James, a British racing driver and the managing director of Nexus, a media and management agency for elite racers worldwide. I ask Will how he funded his passion to become a racing driver. What's it like starting your racing career in your 20s? I find out what it's really like to go around the tracks and compete at Thruxton, Silverstone and Brands Hatch. I asked Will about his race strategy and scariest moments within the car, and we spoke about the schemes and pathways that can help anyone become a race driver today. And before we get our gloves on, helmet on and get into the car, it's best if you stick around at the end of the interview to find out what license you need in order to get yourself out on a racetrack as soon as you like. Well, so, you know, looking back in the memory books, like, what got you into racing in the first place?
Well, so basically, I've always liked racing, like, even when I was a kid. I think, like, a great number of people, saw Formula One growing up. I was particularly obsessed around the Braun GP era, so I always have a soft spot for that team, they had obviously the most incredible season. So, yeah, I've been into racing and sort of interest in sport for a long time. But given my background and kind of where I came from, it was never something that was ever going to be on the cards. You know, I couldn't go karting or anything like that. So compared to most, I came to the sport really late. So I started when I was, I think I first had the sort of thought of, okay, maybe I want to get into racing when I was 26. So most people start when they're 4 years old. So I had a hell of a lot of catching up to do. So I started the process of obviously getting my license and going through all of that. And eventually started racing when I was 27. Did that for just over a year in a single-seater category called F1000, which was cool. Learned a lot. The car was incredibly fast, possibly one of the fastest things I'll ever drive. Also one of the most dangerous. They are quite scary things to drive. But and then since then, it's been a bit of a wild ride because alongside obviously doing the racing, I then started working in the sport. So from a media marketing and PR standpoint, which has led to me doing what I do now, which is managing some of the coolest racing drivers, I like to think, in the UK and in Europe. So doing sort of sports management, marketing and PR for them. That takes me to some interesting places that,
No doubt. And sort of looking back, as a child wanting to, perhaps take up karting or racing, sitting there with your parents and stuff with this pipe dream, as it were, how did your parents react when you first said, "Mum, Dad, I'm going to do it"?
Yeah, well, so for me, the story's a bit different to most because I actually grew up in foster care. So I unfortunately don't actually have real parents, which is absolutely fine. I'm okay with that. But I have a wonderfully supportive foster family. So when I was living with them, I was very much at that stage where I'd loved the idea of being a racing driver. I mean, what little young chap wouldn't? But I never really sort of wanted to get into the support, because I think actually for me at the time, I just knew it wasn't possible. So almost didn't really entertain the idea. But they knew I was obsessed with cars, so I regularly got to, you know, go to like the car museums, all the usual sorts of things. And yeah, they were always super supportive. But yeah, actually getting into the sport came, obviously, like I said earlier, like quite late in my story. and I shared it with them then. And I think the instant reaction was, "You're crazy," which is fair. I think most of my friends, they thought the same as well. You know, kind of for them, I just sort of woke up one day and went, "Right, I'm going to become a racing driver. I'm going to do this." Which sort of looking at where my life was at the time just seemed a little bit mad. Even I would have bit that. But didn't give up though. Did lots of research, obviously, found the series I then went to race in. And fortunately, I built up a business myself at the time, so I could put the money in from my side, and also managed to get some amazing sponsors. So yeah, sort of one thing led to another, and I eventually got going. But yeah, family and friends have always been super supportive, albeit slightly confused as to how crazy it's all just got over the last year.
Yeah, and by those standards, it's bloody meteoric.
Yeah, you know, it's been a wild ride.
So, you know, obviously seeing and believing are two different things, right? So
yeah.
You know, you said that you sort of part-funded the journey, well, completely self-funded the journey. How much kind of money did you have to put into this to make it a reality?
Yeah, probably too much. I sort of referred to it the other day when I was talking to someone about it, like the starter kit for racing. So that's your license, all of your initial stuff. So things like your race helmets, your suits, gloves, shoes, the list goes on, you know. For that initial bit, it was probably around just under £5,000. So that's just to make sure you have all of getting everything you need to safely go racing. And then for me, I had some support from sponsors, which certainly helped. Made it feel less painful every time you just go to beep your cars. But the cost to go racing in F1000 at the time was about £40,000 for the year. So heck of a lot of money. Certainly probably couldn't have done it at the time without that support from sponsors. But yeah, it's a lot, ain't? But going into the series, which I'm hoping to target for 2025 and beyond, unfortunately it's quite a lot more. It's about 150,000. I'd say, like, I really want to pursue a career in GT racing. So fortunately with my job, I actually work with an Aston Martin race team. So I'm a head of comms, so everything marketing, media, and PR I do for them. I've started hitting them up. I was like, "Stay, when can I have a go?" So hopefully we'll be testing with Aston Martin. But I've also been offered a couple of drives recently, I think because of the marketing of the TR and all that sort of stuff that I do for myself. Sponsors are quite interested in helping to push. There's a couple of drive options in the BMW series here in the UK. And there's also Ginetta as well. So who knows? Everything's moving quite fast, but I hope Jack and Rachel is
I was going to say, it's moving quick, but it's moving in the right direction.
Yeah, that's it. No complaints from my side. You know, a lot of late nights and early starts. I'm certainly tired of feeling it, but it is really, it's exciting because you sort of see this thing building in front of you. And obviously with the several years of hard work that I've put in behind the scenes, it's nice to see it sort of starting to pay off. And I just hope I can do everyone proud, you know, when the moment comes and we maybe do get the drives, that I can do well and give it some beers.
Absolutely. And, you know, you've spoken a lot about the financial side, but in terms of physically, you know, what do you have to do to be physically fit to be a race driver?
Yeah. So quite a lot. I think people are, when you really break it down and show people, I think they're quite surprised at the level of physicality that's involved in racing. So when I was training with F1000, they are so fast, those cars. We're talking sort of 0 to 60 in 2.5 seconds. They go up to 145 miles an hour. So, you know, you do feel the effects, albeit not to the levels of Formula One, but things like G-forces and that sort of stuff. So to do well and so that you don't sort of start fading mid-race, you have to do a lot of core. If you train your neck as well, lots of sort of cardio work just to kind of help build up your endurance. So yeah, and then obviously when I'm transitioning now into the GG side of things, it's slightly different because F1000 is sort of full pelt, 15 minutes of just go, 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 go. It's very intense. But for GT, it's an hour to 90 minutes to 2 hours, 3 hours. So, you know, you have to train slightly differently, but it's a lot of cardio and, you know, gym every day if you can. I'd be honest and say I don't do it that much, but trying to balance travel and work and whatnot. But yeah, whenever you can, it's sort of run 5Ks, do circuits, lots of stuff. And then, you know, that then affects obviously the things that I need to eat. So certainly in the season and in the run up to races, you know, you don't drink alcohol, you've got to just keep hydrated, eat quite lean foods, things like that. So yeah, no pizza nights with friends or anything like that, unfortunately.
Yeah, you know, you can't be having a cheeky Domino's, but
no, that's it.
So in terms of, you know, ideal race driver, you know, poster boy, if you like, what is the, is there an ideal height and weight, you know, what's the situation with
that's a good question, actually. I'd say there's no perfect formula, but you know, in the general scheme of things, you don't want to be too heavy, you don't want to be too tall. I'm probably just about at the limit because I'm 6'1", so in some cars I do struggle to fit and get in easily. So I was out the other week for a new Aston Martin GT4 that the team have brought in, and yeah, sort of trying to duck in and get in. And if I had my full helmet on, I'd probably be headbutting the roll bar every time. But it's, yeah, it's sort of not really a perfect size and shape. But yeah, you've got to be slim, I would say, is generally the prerequisite. But yeah, obviously, it's like lightest possible as well.
Just because I think people wonder, you know, you look at F1, you look at any type of race, even WRC or anything like that. And yeah, you know, there are an array of height differences and weight differences. So that's why I asked. And, you know, suiting up for the first time, almost feeling like a superhero, going out to it's very dangerous, you know. How do you feel about putting yourself in those scenarios?
Yeah, do you know, obviously, the first couple of races I did, no harm in admitting I was terrified, because I think there was two sides of the coin for me, because I knew how much work I put into actually being able to get in the car, like, suit up and get ready for that first race. And I didn't want to make silly mistakes or, you know, have a crash or anything, because you never know what's going to happen when you go out to race. But I think on the other side, obviously, I was very excited because it was a culmination of many years' hard work. And it was cool. You know, I get to go out there and I get to go and race these guys, and they're not slow. So it was going to be a challenge. It was tough. But yeah, that I do recall quite vividly. One of my first races was Silverstone. So as venues go, not a bad one to debut. But it was pretty intense. I had obviously my friends there, which was amazing. So my best mate Matt came down. And yeah, it was weird. I was sort of putting on the seat like going, okay, no pressure, but this is like 3.5 years work here. Don't mess it up. And fortunately it went really well. It was such a cool experience in the end. It was nice to obviously have everyone there cheering on. But yeah, it's tense when those lights are going out. You're like, oh God, it's about to happen. And for me, it's almost a bit of sensory overload, because you're in the car. It was quite a warm day, so I was pretty hot. You know, you've got a really thick race suit on. You've got your fireproofs underneath. So, and then you've got obviously the noise of the engine, and then 20 other engines right next to you. And then so you've got to watch out for the marshals. You've got to make sure you line up in your grid box. Like, it's a lot, but yeah, got taught a few tricks of the trade just to try and keep calm at that moment. And yeah, fortunately I managed to have a good race, so that was nice.
So when you were in those first earlier races, earning your stripes, so to speak, in terms of, you know, just staying in the race mentally and physically, and, you know, not being flustered by people overtaking you, or, you know, going into those hairpins.
Yeah, and that did happen, I should say.
Yeah, how did you cope with that and stay focused?
Yeah, do you know, I think it was hard, because in one of the races, we do three over the course of a traditional weekend. So I basically had a good first race. I think, you know, didn't set too high expectations. I certainly wasn't going to win a race, because these guys have been racing in that series for 4 or 5 years. So I sort of went in and was pretty calm, made the most of it, learned a lot, and started to find like the limit of where I could push. But the second race, I just had a bit of a wobble. I got into my own head. I drove like an idiot. You know, I was getting really frustrated that I wasn't able to push the car on the corners that I wanted to. I did find myself getting overtaken a few times, and yeah, just had a bit of a meltdown. So it was only towards the end of those that race. And like I say, they're only 16 minutes in F1000, so they're not terribly long. But I just sort of said, you know, reframed in my head, look, you're here to enjoy it. That's the main thing. Actually, you don't have a point to prove at this point. It's your first season in the sport. So it's not like you're expected to be on the podium and winning everything. Although that would be really nice. Certainly help with the sponsorship, you know. But kind of woke back up again and said, hey, look, just enjoy these last few laps because, yeah, you don't know how long you're going to be able to be out here racing. So then go driving in anger, actually just put in a good effort, but enjoy the whole experience. So, yeah, there is a few sort of, yeah, things like that. And then actually the last race of the weekend, I felt like I was on fire. I was going for it, having a great time, and scored some good points, so not too bad.
I made up for you. And when you were in that, well, can't speak, when you were seeing, you know, yourself driving in those, you know, early stages or maybe getting into the middle, and you saw things that potentially were dangerous, like almost a crash or anything like that, how does that make you feel?
It's really strange. I mean, in one part, I would say for the most part, actually, you can't afford to really think about it too much because there were some pretty nasty crashes. I mean, in the last weekend that I did in the series, we were at Silverstone International. I was at the back of the grid starting, not my favorite best, and there was a few cars in front, and they had a huge, and we're talking a big explosion of a crash right in front of me just off the start of the race. So the lights went out, I then started to creep forward, and we, at this point, we were probably doing 50, 60 miles an hour, and basically one of the cars just over to the left of me, I think they ran over oil, something weird happened, this whole car turned and went straight into the side of another competitor. So that wasn't the nicest thing, you know, dodging car parts whilst also not trying to crash and keep in the game. I think it made you realize actually that the series is, yeah, kind of dangerous. but you know, you just have to play it smart. I think with single seaters and open wheels cars in general, you don't want to be sort of coming too close to another car, because if you clip a wheel, you could be flipped, they could be flipped. You know, I suppose the potential of what could happen if we were to make it as bad as possible is pretty profound. But fortunately, there's a lot of safety measures in place. So, yeah, I think for me, it was just trying to, be smart and make sure I don't put the car in a position where it's likely to go wrong or otherwise. And then when you finish the race, that's maybe when you have more time to think, because there's so much information being thrown at you throughout the race. But yeah, it kind of keeps you distracted from thinking about it too much.
Good answer. Thanks. And in terms of your crew and the race strategy and things like that, can you talk us through some of the way that is sort of brought out?
Yeah, so in terms of like how do we make the decisions, you mean? Or I mean, so with F1000, because the races were so short, so I'd say 15 minutes, there's not a huge amount of strategy that you can do. I think it's really just the case that, you know, you might decide what set of tires you're going to put on, and yeah, you discuss what will happen under the, if a safety car comes out. But it's not like Formula One where you then have to box and then change from your tires, or you might be doing set. It's like how you want the car, and just run with it, basically. Whereas in GT, the other stuff that ends up involved in, there's a lot more strategy that goes on, because we race for 2 hours, 3 hours at a time. So for then, it's actually trying to manage things like fuel loads. At what point in the race do we might maybe want to pit? Obviously, in that region, comes to the car and back. So the team are really, they're incredible, like with the guys I work with at the Aston Martin team, because yeah, we've got some real smart people in there. They've been there, done it, bought the t-shirt many a times. And, you know, just there's a guy that we work with. We call him the prof, Nino Professor. And he is the smartest man I've ever met, because he'll just be there like on his spreadsheets, which I have to say they are like a work of art. And I'm not too much into the spreadsheets myself, but I can appreciate what he's built. And he can kind of predict most things, and just, for me, it just seems like he presses a few buttons and then it spits out a really good strategy option. So, and we relay that back to the drivers, we get the feedback, and then go, oh, actually, okay, the tyres feel better than expected at this stint in the race. So let's maybe push for a few more laps, or, you know, we can then be quite reactive to what the other teams in the grid are doing. So, you know, the last race we did over in Spain, we were chasing down the lead with a McLaren, you know, A-box. We decided to stay out and try and build a bit of a gap and then boxed ourselves. And, yeah, it's fast-paced, but I love all that because I just get to sit there and sort of appreciate it. I'm not making that decision, thankfully. Nobody wants that. I would possibly get that wrong. But, you know, it's really good to kind of see how it works. And actually, for me, I just sit there appreciating it, admiring the team. I'm like, wow, we've got some good people here. This is great.
And, you know, you kind of touched on it then, the relationship between, you know, the race crew and the driver. But what happens when the driver feels like they know better because they're actually physically doing it?
I think, you know, we work really well as a team. Like, we made a point before the season started to make sure that, you know, we just spend some time together, you know, hang out, have a beer or two, and sort of get to know each other. And then obviously understand, okay, this person's style is X, Y, and Z, and this is how I like to work. So I think at the start of the season, we were really prepared and knew what was kind of going on. But yeah, there are those moments where the team might say, hey, look, we think that the tyres are going to go off at a select point. And the driver's the one physically there, you know, they're the one that are feeling whatever it is that they're feeling. So for them, they, you know, we can take a bit of input, and actually there is a conversation that's always back and forth before we end up coming into pit. So if the driver really feels strongly about it, they can just make that opinion known, and the team will go, okay, you know, weigh up the options, what's the risk here, you know, based on whatever objective we're trying to do. In most cases it's go for the win, but you know, if we think that, okay, this track might present a higher chance of bringing out a safety car, and that will bunch everyone up, you know, do we box now, do we box later?
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So yeah, we tend to just sort of chat it through, and ultimately for the team, there is a final decision maker, which is our team manager, Joe. So if he says we're coming in, we're coming in. But again, his role is really to kind of bring in all of those data points to make that decision and try and time it as well as possible as well.
What happens when, you know, for all intents and purposes, on paper, you've had the, you know, the strategy's been there, it's been great, but you're out there and it's just not working. It goes wrong. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what do you do in that moment?
Yeah, I mean, it does happen. We have to say with our team, fortunately, it's quite rare. But, you know, sometimes we can predict that a setup is a good option for the race, given things like weather, what we think our competitors are doing and things like that. But sometimes they are just quicker. We had it a few weeks ago. We were racing with one of the current teams and they did something different. We couldn't figure it out necessarily at the time because it just sort of surprised us that they were suddenly so fast. And we were like, oh, okay, this is interesting. Spices things up a bit. And unfortunately, we just had to manage that problem as best as possible. So for us, we knew that maybe we didn't have the pace in the car to be able to push for the win. But really, it was about trying to play it smart so that we can maintain second place. Fortunately, by finishing then, it didn't affect the points leading the championship. So it's, you know, because they kind of came from outside the path and we were just like, where did you come from? So, you know, in that sense, it wasn't too bad. But yeah, like I say, we just have to manage the risk. It's not, no one wants to lose or miss out on a podium if they didn't help it. But yeah, like I say, with HP2, it wasn't too bad. And yeah, we just have to make sure that the guys behind don't pull any clever tricks and try and take our position off of that. So, but you know, drive a bit more defensively if we need to. Make sure where we're positioning the car on track is in such a way that it makes overtaking as almost impossible, you know. So yeah, there's things we can do, but sometimes just go your way and sometimes it doesn't. That's racing, I guess. That's life as well, right?
Absolutely. And just picking up on what you said there, defending in any sport is an art form. How difficult is it to defend a line?
It can be very difficult. Depends who's chasing you down. And obviously things like track condition, tire wear, all that sort of stuff, they all play an important role. But it can be very difficult. I mean, I have to say that where we work with quite a few different drivers across series like Formula 4, F3 and all that sort of stuff, we get to see the drivers, or at least, you know, we see them out on track and then we can tune into what's happening on the radios. But some of the strategic minds that are behind the wheels of these cars are so impressive because they'll just know that, okay, my tires are in a certain window, maybe they're not optimal, they haven't got maximum grip. So, you know, they place the car in such a way that actually they kind of manage that a car might be trying to take them on the inside or go wide or whatever. And yeah, they have to be really, you're switched on all the time. You know, and I had it when I was racing as well. You know, people are trying to kind of lunge down the inside, and it's like, okay, if I move a little bit further to the left, that's going to be a really bad idea for them. They might risk locking up. So you can be cheeky, but obviously the one thing you always want to avoid is contact. Nobody wants it. Things get very expensive very quickly if you start going that way. So yeah, it's difficult. There's a lot that goes into it, for sure.
No, I mean, I always wondered, again, it's just that you see it all the time, and obviously forgive me, but mostly I see it in Formula One. And you know, it just looks complicated, because part of you wants to keep pushing for P1 and like trying to actually win the race, but at the same time you need to defend your position so that, you know, you don't risk it all and end up losing positions needlessly.
That's it. You almost you raise a good point there, because actually if you think about it, if you know, given race styles being the way that they are, if, you know, the race gets underway and I'm in P1, I'm pushing as hard as I can, you know, full chat the entire race, there's going to be a point where maybe I risk damaging the engine of the car, or something could go wrong with transmission, the tires could fall off a cliff. So, you know, you have to play it cool and actually, yeah, like I say, it's that strategic mindset. That's one thing that all the best racing drivers are very, very good at, because they can understand that, you know, I've got 2 hours to go here, and I've got one or two sets of tires, and I've got to make this town. So if I try the really aggressive line, and I'm trying to be sort of, you know, swerving all over the place, I'm just scrubbing tires, and it's not, you know, you're going to lose your grip and all those sorts of things. So actually, it's a case of knowing that you may be coming into box in a few laps, let the car by, because you're going to catch them up on a fresh set next time. So, you know, it's all of these different things that happen. And yeah, I'm surprised half these guys don't get out of the car at the end of the race and they're just exhausted. I mean, some are, because it's not easy, especially with the Formula drivers who work with they're pushing but the whole race distance. But yeah, it's pretty impressive to see in the flat.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think, as I said, the amount of mental cognitive work that goes into driving is, you know, it's off the chart. In terms of, you know, moving more towards the pageantry and the spectacle of, you know, the racing that you've participated in, how many people sort of come along to watch, and what size of the events are? What are they like?
So, I mean, it does vary. So I think two weekends ago, we were in Valencia for one of the rounds in the European GC4 series. We had 10,000 people there. So that was a great turnout. You know, when I was doing my racing, sometimes you'd have 1,000 people. So it really depends on things like who is organizing the race events, how well promoted they are, and that sort of thing. So I was racing under the 750 Motor Club at the time. And that was more for the sort of more on the hobbyist side of racing, I would say, you know, people that wanted to sort of dip the toe in, experience it, build a bit of expertise or experience in that sport, and then maybe go on to higher categories, which is where obviously I'm now pushing. So they, you know, I wouldn't ever, yeah, there's never like full grandstands or anything like that. But, you know, we work in British GT and with SRO and things like that. They're amazing because they've got 20,000 people, you know, you've got loads and loads of fans, and it's the pageantry, as you call it, you know, it's 10 times. It's really impressive to see.
How do you manage that, knowing that someone's watching you?
It's a good question, because I think that you can let it go one of two ways. You can let it sort of push you on and be like, right, well, you know, let's not mess this up because I'm going to look really stupid. So it kind of focuses your mind. But, you know, if there are points in the race, setting up the safety cars, you because during the race, you don't often get a chance to look at anything else as opposed to where's that fog, where's my line, what's the breaking point, okay, what gear am I in, how do I need to respond to the challenge from behind? So you're very occupied. So you could have 100,000 people there or 10, and you wouldn't necessarily pick it up. But when things like safety cars come out, you're like, well, there's quite a lot of people on these grandstands, and maybe it becomes a thought process. But yeah, it's... yeah, I think for me, like, I've never really sort of, weirdly, I've not really thought about it, because normally if I'm at the races with, you know, our drivers, if it's in the single seaters or the GT side, which is there doing a job, so you don't often sort of look up and go, oh, wow, there's a lot of people in that grandstand. But yeah, it's quite cool as well, especially when you come over the line if you've scored some good points, and you can hear at that point, because you tend to sort of wake up to what's actually going on around you. You hear people cheering, screaming or whatever. It's cool. Also slightly crazy.
You must feel like you're in a movie for that moment.
Yeah, do you know, there's been a few movie moments this year, I have to say. Just the places we've been to, the people we've met and all that sort of stuff. I think earlier in the year we were in the UAE. So I've had a supporting a guy called Reza that I've worked with for a long time now. And we were walking up and down the paddock, and I was like, oh, that's so-and-so. And, you know, we had like Fittipaldi there, and we had Pablo Montoya, and you sort of shake these guys' hands. And it's just, for them, it's like another day at the races. They don't care. But you're just like, I literally looked up to you for many years. It's like someone else stood in front of you. This is kind of weird. So you obviously don't have to play a call, like it doesn't actually matter inside you're screaming. But yeah, it's really cool. I love this industry for sure.
And, you know, the size of the competitions that you've competed in previously and will in the future, what's the prize money, or like what's the reward? What are you racing for?
Yeah, I get asked this a lot because, you know, a few people sort of say to us, you know, how much do you get paid to race? And really the short answer is it depends, because you might as well say that actually most racing series outside of things like F1, and they pay everything for everything ourselves. So if we look at, you know, when I first started out in, say, F1000, because of the type of club and everything else, everything was paid for by me. And the only way that I could make it work was by being really good at getting sponsors. So actually pitching myself, proposing to them, hey, let's do this cool marketing idea or this event together, and that would raise some money that then goes back into racing. So yeah, really, the driver is at the epicenter of all of that. And, you know, like I say, up until you get to things like F1, where you've maybe won all the championships before, showed that you were really, really quick, you know, and then obviously you go into that elevated platform that F1 is, you know, it's broadcast around the world and all of those things. Then people are like, it's more easy to sort of try and chuck money away and say, hey, let's do something. I want to be associated to you in the series. So it's it was really interesting actually getting to learn that in the first place, because yeah, I think if you're not in the industry, it's very, nobody talks about it really. I think it's becoming more of a conversation now that things like the Drive to Survive stuff's come out, and, you know, I think the sort of various podcasts and TV shows which are asking these questions. But yeah, it's tough, and obviously I deal with it for quite a few different drivers. You know, the costs to go racing in some of these series is crazy. You know, Formula 4 is now over $500,000. In some cases, so the drivers have to find that from somewhere, and it's, yeah, fortunately we help with that, but it's still a lot to find for anyone. And yeah, so that was an interesting discovery when I first figured that out. Yeah.
I bet. And for anyone listening, they're thinking, boy, I'm never going to be able to do this. Are there any schemes or anything that someone can appeal to get involved?
Yeah, I mean, so I had the exact same thought when I got started. Fortunately, I found a way that worked for me personally, and I figured a way through those challenges, because, yeah, it's so expensive. That's the biggest reason why so many people don't go further or even get started in the first place. But I think now, because the commercial interest, so things like sponsors and the marketing potential of certain categories has grown so much in recent years, there are quite a few sort of initiatives and schemes, particularly more on trying to encourage women into the sport, which I'm a really big fan of. We work with some really talented female drivers, and you've got things, most notably the F1 Academy, for example. So the way that works is the F1 sponsor for one of the select teams will agree as part of their sponsorship deal to front a very large proportion of the costs for those women to go racing. And then the athlete themselves only has to bring a very small amount. So, you know, there's the support in that sense. It's still a lot to find. You know, for an F1 Academy seat in 2024, it's €100,000 the driver has to find. So, and then obviously the team supplement over $500,000 of that, which is very generous of them. But it's still a heck of a lot to find. Whereas, yeah, there's different things like scholarships available. There's certainly this last 2 years, because the message of motorsport's too expensive has been quite profound. A lot of race teams have now said, hey, look, let's just do, they do it quite creatively sometimes, where they'll sell tickets where you can pay £500 as a driver. You get entered into the draw, and then maybe you can win a seat that way. And obviously, lots of people pay trans pays for the season. But some sports are also investing in, you know, actually just trying to find the right drivers. They might go to Carson Paddocks, they might go to places like the 750 Motor Club, potentially find drivers that show promise and potential, and then they might do it. And then even for us at Nexus, you know, we're actually looking to fund drivers where we can. You know, we do that part of trying to find them sponsors, but you know, we're also looking potentially down the line at a sponsorship program so we can fund seasons and select racing categories. And I know we won't be one of possibly be one of the first to really do that properly, but hopefully a lot of companies copy and follow. That would be nice. So yeah, it's an ever-evolving and changing situation, but I would say in 6 months to a year, hopefully there'll be more opportunities. And yeah, we can get those people that actually are like the Max Verstappens of the world that maybe don't have the budget to come into the sport. So they'll shake things up and it'll be really impressive to see.
That's a really important thing to note then. So what are the characteristics of a racing driver?
Interesting, because I would say they'll always work out very frequently and things like that. They try and do simulator practice all the time. So I would say dedication for sure. I think also as well, like, they really have to back themselves. I think with the way that the motorsport landscape's evolving at the moment, it's really hard. You know, the pressures that these drivers face, the challenges they have just to be able to sit in the seat and go racing. You know, they have to really almost like believe that they can do it. And you know, when you've got 100 people screaming at you saying you're never going to make it, you have to be able to block that out and still carry on anyway. You know, even at a small level, I had that when I first started. I had some haters that thought, what's this guy doing? He's a nobody. He shouldn't be here. And, you know, some are more vocal than others at saying that. But, you know, I kind of, weirdly for me, and much the same as our other drivers do, you have to use that as fuel and say, I'm going to prove you wrong. And, you know, don't get bitter or angry about it. Actually just be like, okay, cool. See you in a year and see if you're still saying the same thing. You know, you've got to really be committed in that sense. And, yeah, there are many moments where I nearly broke, but I still kept pushing on because I just love, once you have a chance to go racing, I think most people, it's they get bitten by that bug and then they're hooked for life. They want to do it as much as they can and go as far as they can and stuff like that. So, yeah, I'm sure I'll probably still be yammering on about motorsport in 10 years' time for sure.
No doubt. And why not? It's only going to get better. The question I had next for you was, in terms of the gap between making it and not making it, so F2 to F1, how big is that gap?
It's huge. I mean, certainly at that level, because you've got 22 seats in F1, or I hope I got that right. That would be embarrassing if I got that wrong. But, you know, and then you've got the entire world. And you know, I'm meeting drivers all the time. Every week we're at a track 3-4 times a week at this point, and everyone's saying the same thing. I'd like to get to F1. And it's like, great. So you're one of 1,000 people that have said that to me in the last month. Only so many of you can be right, which I wish that maybe wasn't the case. I wish everyone could have a go at F1. Great, you know, see what these powerful machines can do. But yeah, it does take a certain type of someone with the perfect. It's almost a bit like a recipe for a cocktail. There's all these different ingredients that go into it to make that what it is. So yeah, you've got to be a rare and certain type of someone. And unfortunately, the reality is at that level for Formula One specifically, not everyone can achieve a goal. And you look at drivers like Lewis Hamilton, Fernando Alonso, and Kimi Raikkonen at the time, you know, they've been occupying those seats in their respective teams for so long. So that's taken what was already a very narrow audience or a very narrow group of people and shortened it even further. So, you know, maybe one, maybe two, maybe three seats become available at the end of this year. We've got about 600,000 people that want to sit in those seats. So, yeah, it's quite tight. But then you look at other series, GT Challenge, British GT, you know, all of those sorts of things. And I think this is why the growth of WEC, ELMS, and those sorts of series has boomed, because actually it is a lot more accessible, because in most cases, if you're doing 3-hour endurance race, you're sharing that with 3 or 4 drivers. So the group of you can be a lot bigger. That means we share costs as teammates. You know, it just makes all of those little problems like seat availability, the costs, everything else just a little bit more accessible. So I think, you know, for us, we've seen a massive boom as an agency in the GT side. So yeah, I think with that, it's a lot easier to get involved. And, you know, there's also lots of other series that are launching all the time, and then people innovating and coming out with new concepts. it is a really exciting time at the moment in our industry. And yeah, there's it'll be interesting to see how it all goes in the next couple of years. But yeah, hopefully that answers your question. I'm not sure.
No, it did. It definitely did. And, you know, knowing motorsport like you do and seeing, you know, the rise of, it's been going for a couple of years, but like things like Formula E and, you know, that nuanced way of racing that's a bit more, I suppose, eco-friendly. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think for me, I'm excited by, you know, Formula E. I think it's an interesting sort of series, and it's certainly an interesting concept, you know, to use electric power. I think it was one of those first series that spurred on the innovation of other things like Extreme E and so on. So I think, you know, by and large, it's a fantastic thing to happen to our sport. I think if it can continue to fuel innovation, which actually we can translate into real-world technologies, which was largely the point of those series, you know, how can we make our road cars better and more efficient and able to perform at that level? You know, I think it's awesome. But I think, you know, at the same time, I'm a bit of a purist in certain senses. You know, I love the combustion engine. You know, I certainly understand it maybe a bit more than the electric powertrains. But yeah, I think, they're ultimately great. And I'd love to see that series continue to be successful. And I know they're also bringing out a boat series powered with a similar concept and platform. So, you know, it's not just tarmac now, it's also waterways that we can compete on. So yeah, it's pretty interesting.
That's pretty cool. And in terms of the drivers that you, you know, you mix with and chat to and help out, and also yourself, is there a willingness to want to go into Formula E?
And do you know, I'll be honest in saying this hesitation, because I think that, I mean, yeah, I think most people, if I said to you, hey, look, I'll give you all the training and all the support you need to go into Formula E, would you do it? I'd be surprised if you said no. Certainly speaking to a lot of the people that I speak to, they would jump at the chance. But I think some have fears that it may pigeonhole them into that particular type of series, or they might find it difficult to forge like the next steps. So, you know, when you do things like GT racing, you can dominate in British.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
GT. And then you can maybe go to European, and then you might transfer into WEC or ELMS. Whereas because of the infancy of these series, like the Formula E, where is the natural next step of progression if you did decide to move on? Or if you hit the pinnacle and you need to retire, you know, all of those sorts of questions do come up. But yeah, at the same time, it's still new. I mean, we're what, season 11 now or season 12? So it's, you know, still got some mileage to run, and these questions could maybe be answered. And like I say, there's all these new series coming up, so it's anyone's guess. But yeah, I think there's a little bit of hesitation. I think also as well, we're actually working with one of the companies that are bringing out a junior Formula E style series, shall we say. They're targeting it to give you a series to the main championship. So with them, actually, from a developmental standpoint, it's very difficult at the moment, because they're actually finding, given that we're in the UK, there's not a lot of understanding of the cars and the risks. So we then look to go testing at a circuit, and they'll go, yeah, you can come and test with us. And then we go, just to check, you know, it's an electric car. And then they go, oh no, we can't have you. This is something we don't understand. How do we, because obviously the concern is that if the battery pack gets ruptured in any way, it then catches on fire. That will burn for several days, and there's no way to extinguish it, because it's all that power has been caged, and now it's releasing itself through fire. So there's a lot of concern in that sense, and I think that doesn't help speed up the adoption of the series, when actually, by and large, they're probably quite safe. There's lots of safeguards you can put in place to make sure we don't smash each other to bits, and, you know, there's debris everywhere, battery acid everywhere. It's not like that, but yeah, it's something we're hoping to work with our partners and trying to resolve, because I want to see the series do well here, and obviously then can transfer into Europe at the same time.
Absolutely. And I want to pick up on something you mentioned earlier about You know, more female drivers and women racing in general. So in the races that you've done, is it quite mixed or has it always been separate?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, and I wish it wasn't the case, but it's just very male dominated. And unfortunately, in quite a few racing series at the moment, that's sadly the truth. But, you know, there are some initiatives and a lot of work has been put in to attract women into the sport. So, you know, I think actually with our clients and the drivers we represent, there's a lot more diversity happening, and I'm super happy to see it. So in Formula 4 this year in Britain, we've got Chloe Chong, we've got Ellen Lloyd. You know, they're obviously going to show the world what's possible, and I have to say they're quite quick and they're great people too. So, you know, I think that'll be interesting to see that, how that affects things. We've got things like the F1 Academy now. So it's, I think there's still some work to do to show the wider community that actually women in sport is a fantastic thing and we should embrace it wholeheartedly. But I think there's obviously, there are questions around, okay, can women actually drive these cars? I mean, I would have been obviously pointing them to watch the series and go, yes, they can. But I think, yeah, then just giving them more opportunities to showcase their abilities and exactly what they can do. So that's one of the things we really push, you know, when we're talking to teams on behalf of drivers, we're trying to, you know, say that, yeah, there's a huge marketing opportunity there. Like, you're going to be one of the first teams to embrace this and show the world what's going on and be a change maker, which is always nice. And then also as well to provide opportunities for those athletes to have all the training, simulator and all that sort of time so that they can just come out and hopefully give the boys a good run for the money, because yeah, certainly the ones we work with, they're very capable. So it's going to be an interesting season.
And touching on that then, how influential are women and the races in the races that you do as part of your team? Like, you know, how does that work?
So in terms of like what the, if you think about influential working in this room?
So within your team, what part do women play?
Yeah, so within the teams that I work with, I'm fortunate to work with quite a few. We have women that work in engineering roles, strategy roles, which I have to say in many cases are actually better than some of the male colleagues that we work with. So, and then more and more, but sadly not as much as I'd like for that to be. Obviously, the women are drivers as well. So yeah, it is a mix. And I think, you know, there's lots of different initiatives from the top of Formula. Women have their own superpowers and we need to embrace them, and they do make the sport better. So yeah, we're seeing more interest from women coming into the sport, whether it's at the sort of science, data and engineering side of things through to the competitive. So yeah, sport's getting a lot better.
Good. I'm pleased to hear it, because, you know, you want to see different people from different walks of life, as well as different people just being on the grid. Like, it'd be awesome to see a woman line up, you know, P1 for the opening race of the Grand Prix. You know, that'd be cool, right?
So, and it will happen. It's just a case of timing, I think. You know, being optimist, also, I think I can see the work that's being done. It won't be long. You know, maybe 5-10 years, but it's a slow process. You know, this sort of middle piece of motorsport as a whole. It's not a fun. Despite the fact that we drive very fast, it, as an organization and an entity and everyone involved, it sometimes struggles to be quick to change. But, you know, it's happening, like, through the ground shaking. And yeah, we'll keep pushing.
Good. And I wanted to ask about kind of the mental side of racing and the aftercare. You know, in as much as in your races and, you know, races of drivers that you know and help and support, what's there for drivers?
Yeah, it's a brilliant question, because I think with the sport as a whole, it's highs and lows, and it's very extreme at certain points. So, you know, I think actually the main thing we have is obviously the team. So for me as a driver, whether it's a good or a bad race, you know, I've got a team there to look after me, who are there to, you know, support me if I want to talk about some things. You know, if there was perhaps a race that didn't go well, they're there to help me break it down, understand, learn, improve, and go back to next time. But then, yeah, sometimes, there are certain things that happen even in my career at this point, and I'm sure there'll be, you know, bumps in the road down the line. But, you know, I think actually just having people there that you can talk to, we're seeing a lot more in the sport, particularly at the elite level that our drivers are working at. You have things like mindset coaches, you have sports counselors. So they come in and actually help the athletes on an individual level. Yeah, just grapple with any issues they might have, give them some practical solutions as to what to do in those moments where maybe things do become too much, or You know, they're having an issue with a certain race, or because, you know, these things happen. So yeah, there's more support now. And I think actually, you know, there was a conversation that's kind of still going on now, is actually about men as men. We don't talk much, and actually tend to harbor a lot of the feelings and the stress and the strain, and of which, given the nature of the beast, there can be quite a lot. So, you know, actually we're seeing more conversations being had, and, you know, actually the officials that work at the races, they're, you know, most faces are brilliant. You know, they actually ask them, drivers, are you okay? How are you feeling? What can we use for you? So I think if you contrasted that to maybe 10 years ago, it would have been very much just a case of shut up, don't talk about it, and go and race. Like, it would be a very different approach. So I think, yeah, a lot of good positive changes has happened, and it's continuing to come into the sport. So yeah, it's good.
No, I'm pleased to hear that. And, you know, as I said, it's rare that you get, you know, this type of insight from someone on the inside, because as a fan watching on TV, you're never really in the loop. You're kind of, you know, 5, 6, 7 steps behind, because you don't really know what's going on, especially when some industries aren't always as transparent. And that's why I suppose the Braun GP Disney series and the Drive to Survive has been so received so well, because I didn't think people necessarily appreciated how difficult it was.
That's it. So true. I think actually on the Drive to Survive thing, like, I don't like to admit it, sometimes you get bashed for it, but it was one of the core reasons that I got into racing was the series, because I think for me, it made me realize, and I think you hit the point really well there, that they are human beings. I know we sort of mostly look at these athletes across sports, you know, boxing, Olympians, racing drivers, whatever. And you just sort of think of them as these sort of celebrity people that do whatever sport it is that they do, and that's kind of it. But actually, they still go home and cry sometimes. They still have personal issues. They've all got their own stories. And I think for me, and my story particularly, as a kid who grew up in foster care and you know, struggled with mental health for many years, you know, I've been very keen through my father's, and actually I've turned what would have maybe been a problem into a superpower by then being able to work with mental health charities through my racing. So it's like, you know, if you're clever, you can use your past to your advantage and try and build something for the racing side. But yeah, it's yeah, I'm sorry, I feel like I went off on a tangent there. But
No, it's good. And thank you for sharing. I mean, look, I was going to say, I know you're really inspired by Ross Brawn and that, you know, 2009, I think it was 2008 season. But so far racing for you, what's been like your most memorable moment or piece of memorabilia that you just have framed or you just love looking at?
It's a good one. Because I've got a few things that popped into my head as you said that, but I think probably the coolest experience or coolest memory I'll probably carry with me for a long time to come is, so I work with this driver called Reza, phenomenal guy, super talented, and here's hoping he goes to F1, because my goodness, does he deserve it. But in January of last year, so trying to, because he was invited to go to Sweden to a place called Race Champions, Pete Alstad was the town. And I was helping with all his media and PR and everything, so he kindly invited him to join. So it was me, him, and his dad, and we went for 5 days in the, what felt like the Arctic, because it was snowing, it was super cold, in the middle of nowhere, like you almost have to helicopter into the place. And yeah, it was crazy. And we literally spent 4 or 5 days with all the guys from Formula One and World Rally and all of those things. So I think, for me, it's probably more the memories than the physical stuff, because you do accumulate a lot of stuff. You know, you always got your access passes that I always keep as memories of the different venues and places I went to. Sometimes you get like media bibs, sometimes you can keep them, sometimes you can't. But, you know, so I collect that stuff, but I think for me, the memories are my favorite, because yeah, we literally, I probably shouldn't admit this, but we had dinner one night and we just got drunk with David Coulthard. Like, it was very cool. You know, Rez was there. He was driving the next day. So he was just having Coca-Cola and that was it. But, you know, we were having a few drinks and just having a good laugh and talking about his experience in Formula One. Valtteri Bottas brought in his gin, which I have to say is amazing. So you should definitely get some. And yeah, like, it was just really weird. And then I was playing ping pong with Mick Schumacher and we had a chat with Sebastian Vettel. Like, I did have this thing, like, who am I? I do not deserve to be here. This is just mind blowing. But, you know, actually, we're all fans of the sport and, you know, we all get it. They're what it takes. And we've all had to work really hard to get there. I think it was just, it was less of that, oh my God, it's Sebastian Vettel. It's just like, do you know what? He's such a nice guy. We just had a chat and now I'm chatting to someone else. And it was really strange.
Yeah, you're like, oh, Seb, do you want to come to my birthday party?
Yeah, oh, gee, I should have asked that. That would have been so cool. Ladies and gentlemen, Sebastian Vettel. Yeah, that would be really good.
And, you know, you've touched on it a few times throughout the call, but you've raced at, you know, some iconic British stadiums. For you, which one's your favourite?
Gonna be Brands Hatch. I am a big fan of that circuit because in the car I drove, which was the single seater, the F1000, it's very fast. There's so much character there, and obviously you've got things like the famous Paddock Hill bend. You kind of enter that at, I think for our cars, we must have entered it at 130 miles an hour. You have to brake on the sort of edge of a pound coin, so to speak, turn in, and then you drop like four stories, and then you come back up four stories. It was there. Essentially a roller coaster, but there was just some amazing moments there. I did some of my best overtakes and, you know, really felt like I was pushing myself and definitely pushed myself beyond my comfort zone, because I think the previous races, all I was just learning, building up and trying to figure out how to drive this thing without killing myself. And yeah, it was awesome. And then I picked up the podium, so not too bad, eh? But I rookie P1, so I'll take that. And it's now proudly planted on my desk at home. Just as a little reminder, so it was cool.
I'd be sleeping with that trophy. Like, do you see how I don't know if you follow football, but how like the goalkeeper for Argentina like slept with the World Cup medal in his bed?
I sleep with it, but I remember driving home from the circuit that night. I basically strapped it in the car with the seatbelt on, and like, I took a little photo just to take the mic with some friends. But yeah, I was very proud of that. And it was strange because it all happened so fast, and because you're in the car, like, we don't have data screens feeding where your timings are, which I think is a good thing, because you then just get angry if you look at the luck of the numbers. It's distracting. But I finished the race. I had no idea like picked up enough points to get the trophy, so I just literally got in the car to go home, and I was with a friend at the time, and we were just like, cool, let's go and maybe stop off for dinner on the way back. And as I was leaving, I passed the rest of the team in the paddock and everything, and we were like, whoa, where are you going? I was like, home. It's the end of the weekend. I'm good to go. Do you need me for anything? They were like, no, you've won something. You should probably stay. So I did. And then I met the championship owner, and he was like, yeah, you've got high scoring novice or the rookie one thing. And I was like, sweet, I'll stay around for that then. posted the photos, and then I got home and put it in the car and everything else. It was good.
I mean, equally, it could have been pretty badass if you were just like, I'm still going home.
Just send
it to me.
That's it. Just put it in the post.
First of many, eh?
I do. So, you know, I hope you're right. And like I say, there's a lot of work to do for the next steps in my career. But, obviously now I've got Nexus. It's grown so quickly. I think at the moment we're one of the fastest growing sports marketing and management agencies in the UK. So it's taking me away from the track a little bit, albeit for away from the driving. But I'm hoping we can do better in GT racing. And yeah, we'll be doing some testing in with Mercedes and with Aston Martin this year. So yeah, it's exciting times. Just sort of push.
Absolutely. And just on Nexus, I was going to ask, for people listening, wanting to know more about Nexus and, you know, how that all works, how would, you know, say if I'm a driver and I want to be represented by you, how would that work?
So basically, you just have to get in touch. We make it super easy, so people can obviously just fill out the form on the website, or in most cases, like I said, it tracks 3 to 4 times a week with the team. So come and say hi. I'm super chatty, you know, I love meeting new people. So I think for us, it's just a case of understanding, okay, what do you want to do? How can we help you? Because in a nice way, we don't want to work with someone we can't help, because it's just, it wouldn't feel right. So, you know, if we think we can help you get to the next level in your career, we've got a lot of tools in our toolbox to help that be the case. So I've got a few colleagues that I work with, they help drivers negotiate better contracts. We also provide all of the media and the press and PR that needs to go into the sport these days. We help them build their brands. And then also we partner with the fitness wearable company Whoop. So, which actually, I think this might be the first time we've publicly announced that. So there you go. But
exclusive.
That's it. We've got, it's super exclusive. But it's exciting because it's, for us, it's something we've been developing for the last couple of months. But what it basically means is all of our athletes get the bands for the whole year for free. and what we can do, because of the amount of data that these bands collect, similar to the data that would come out of a race car, you know, we look at all of the key performance criteria, look for ways to improve. Our trainers actively monitor the drivers so that we can see that, okay, they really struggled in that race, or they're not training hard enough, or they're not getting good sleep. And then we plug in the coaches and everyone that can help them to optimize what they're trying to achieve. And it's really good. And it's a massive innovation for our industry, because I think people just go, oh, go to the gym, eat well, here's a fitness plan, off you go. Whereas actually, because yeah. I can, if I wanted to, I could monitor your heart rate live and then actively feed in support. I think for us, it gives us a bit of a competitive edge. So yeah, we do a lot, and obviously help drivers get sponsors. Because we would normally help you build your brand and your profile in the sport, and more broadly, we'll then actually be able to pitch you to sponsors and say, hey, look, this driver's got a particularly interesting story. We can build in some really cutting stuff together. Let's do some campaigns. Let's do some marketing, get you down to the track, and we host them, look after them. And yeah, it's a lot that we do. Keeps me busy.
I was going to say, I don't know where sleeping and just normal social life comes in.
Oh, yeah, you stuff it in where you can. It's not. So, yeah, but it's cool. I mean, it means you get to work with some cool people. You know, we're sort of GB3, British F4. We're also doing some stuff over in Abu Dhabi later this year, which I'm really excited about. We're also expanding to Europe. So it's cool. But, yeah, and I have to say, we need to get you to a race. I feel like that needs to happen.
100%. I mean, I'll come whenever. And also, thank you. I was going to say, for people who are listening who are like, oh, you know, I don't necessarily want to be in the car racing, but I would love to be part of the pit crew, or love to be an engineer and, you know, be the mind behind the cars. Do you have any support for that?
You know, getting around, we should certainly recommend people. It's not something we exclusively focus on, but, you know, for me, I'd love the sport, and I'd love for more people to come into it, and from both their staff rounds and things like that. So, yeah, always have to do intros and then help where I can. Like, you know, because it's one of those things, I valued it when I got that support when I first started, and it wasn't easy to come by then. So trying to, again, make a bit of a change there and help people along the way.
Love that. Thank you. And just to kind of round off then, what's the future for yourself as a racing driver?
Well, so I'm targeting British GT. That would be amazing. It's quite a tall order. You know, like I said, I've started this way later in life than anybody really should. So we'll see how we go. But I think for the next year, later this year, I'll be doing my first full endurance race. I'll actually be racing at Spa. I'm very excited by that. So
it is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Be doing a 25-hour endurance race, so not 24, it's 1 hour better. But
wow.
Yeah, I'll be doing that in a series called Fun Cup, which is pretty bizarre. So me and actually a lot of the top drivers I work with, we're coming together, we forged a team, we've got three cars that we're entering, it's going to be crazy. And then, like I say, I'll be doing some testing with Mercedes GT4 and Aston Martin GT4 later this year, and then obviously with Janetta as well. So I'm excited by that. But yeah, it's really just about experience gathering this year, trying to adapt to the new model of car and you know, going from single seaters to GT. It's not the easiest of transitions, but putting in all the work, tons of simulator, tons of fitness training, and then 2025 we're going to come out swinging and give it the best shot we can.
Love that. And just to wrap up then, who or what inspires you?
Oh, that's really interesting. Do you know, I would have to say the person that came to mind would be my foster mum, Helen, because I love her to bits. She's like the best mum anyone could ever ask for. I think with limitless kindness, passion, you know, she's such a sweet lady and gives so much to others. I think for me, that inspires me a lot, because I think, you know, she helped me so much in life. You know, where I came from was not a good place. And now she's helped me to also build a good life for myself. And, you know, I think where possible, she shows me that that's something I should always try and help others do. So, you know, never stand in anyone's way, always show support. You know, be charitable, be kind, and those sorts of things. But then I would say from a racing standpoint, actually quite a lot of my clients really inspire me, because, you know, we work with some incredible people. I think, you know, a chap called Reza I mentioned earlier, and Mighty, just getting to work so close to your fan and understand how they tackle the challenge that's in front of them in terms of the racing and all the hard work they put in, it just pushes me to want to do more, because they want it so badly. So I sort of want it so badly for them too. And that's the same with all of our clients, fortunately. So yeah, I guess my foster mum and our clients would be the two.
I think that's a perfect place to leave it. And, you know, thank you, Helen, for the great work she's done to make you into the man that you are today.
Yeah, it's terrific. Thank you, Helen. She's great. Round of applause to Helen, huh?
Without Helen, there's no rookie.
That's it.
Got a trophy. But no, thank you so much for your time today. I've really enjoyed it, and listening to the nuances of racing and learning about, you know, everything from women in sport, women in racing, just learning about what it actually takes to be a race driver and all of the sacrifices that you've made to get to where you are. And thank I'll you. Definitely be taking you up on that invitation to a race. So
let's do it. Yeah. Don't let me forget this. We'll make it happen this year. That'll be amazing.
I'm like a dog with a bone, mate.
Thank you for listening to this episode of An Athlete's Blueprint. The authentic stories shared in this podcast aren't for everybody. They were just for you, a true sports enthusiast. Whether you're going into your next practice session or at the starting line for the finals, take the winner's insight from the athletes and the coaches you heard from today. Remember, this advice is only available on An Athlete's Blueprint podcast.
What license do I need to race? So my answer would be, if you're looking to get into racing, obviously the first thing you need to do is to get your ARDS license. For me, I actually did this at Thruxton Circuit down in the south of the UK, but there's loads of circuits all across the country that offer the course. It's relatively easy. So part of it is you do an exam where you have to remember all your flags. So there's 13 flags, all meaning different things. So as long as you ace that, you can't get a single one wrong. And then you just have to answer some basic common sense questions. You know, things like if you drop your helmet, what do you do? And all those sorts of things, just to make sure you know your responsibilities as a driver. And then after that, you head out on track. So for me, I went out in a sort of small hatchback car. And just did a couple of laps just to show that I knew the basics of a racing line and what to do and how to respond to other cars on track. And yeah, it was super easy. And it's relatively cheap. Most places do it for about sort of £300 to £400. And that's the one thing you need in order to head out on track. So definitely take that off your list first if you want to go racing. And then after that, yeah, just obviously get some testing and build up as much experience as you can.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.